Now, activist and author Gloria Steinem was in Wisconsin recently for the 80th anniversary of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. She talked about reproductive rights as an extension of human rights at a Milwaukee event that drew 1,300 supporters.
Since Steinem's event, the political landscape and its relation to reproductive rights has changed dramatically with the election of Donald Trump. Trump and Vice President-elect Mike Pence are opponents of abortion, and some anti-abortion activists are hoping, advocates are hoping the new Republican leadership will ultimately overturn the Roe versus Wade ruling.
Gloria Steinem joins us now. She's a writer, lecturer, editor, and feminist activist. In 1972, she co-founded Ms. Magazine. Her books include Revolution from Within and My Life on the Road. Gloria, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, some advocates of reproductive rights are concerned about what a Trump presidency could mean. Are you concerned about that future right now?
Yes, I'm very concerned. I don't know anyone who is not concerned because he has made it semi-clear, at least, that he thinks that women, for instance, who need an abortion, which means one in three American women at some time in their lives, that they should be subject to punishment in some way. And there is the whole question, of course, of funding for Planned Parenthood. There is the question of contraception as part of medical plans. So it would be difficult to think of reasons for more concern, including his vice president, Pence, who has been ferociously anti-women's decision-making over our own reproductive life.
And the most obvious issue when we talk about reproductive rights is abortion, but you mentioned some others. Are there other aspects of this that you think are also something that supporters of reproductive rights should be worried about right now?
Yes, all the discussions that we have had about contraception under Obamacare, for instance, could now be everything we fought for there might be reversed as well. And there's also the question of funding for Planned Parenthood in general, and the fact that its functions have only 1% to do with abortion seems quite lost on its adversaries. So I think we're all on high alert.
And what do you anticipate in terms of sort of the opening volleys in terms of reproductive rights? Do you expect this to be a front of the pack issue, or do you think this is something that will come up more slowly?
You know, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Because we are in uncharted territory. We have never had before a president with so little experience, with no political experience, with no governing experience, and with so little knowledge. I mean, when asked about Roe v. Wade, he just said, well, you know, after it's overturned, women can go to some other state. He himself, I think, doesn't know that his supporters, or he may not know that his supporters want a human life amendment in the Constitution, which would declare the fertilized egg to be a person. So it would essentially nationalize women's bodies throughout our childbearing years. That's the stated goal of his supporters. But I think he does not know that. I'm not sure that he has any belief other than what is helpful to him at the moment, but the people around him clearly are, for the most part, anti-reproductive freedom.
This was a super highly charged election for both sides, and in the end, some voters chose Donald Trump because they were single-issue voters and they wanted to see Roe v. Wade overturned. What do you make of the fact that decades after Roe v. Wade was passed, abortion remains a force for a segment of voters today?
Well, I think that the whole question of, every hierarchy seems to begin with controlling reproduction and therefore controlling women. And every democracy seems to begin with the understanding that we, each of us, as human beings, get to govern our own bodies. That is, the power of the state stops at our skins. So it is very, very fundamental. And controlling women in order to control reproduction it means there is dominance and violence towards women in much of the world, so much so that now when you add up all the forms of violence against women, there are actually fewer women on earth, fewer females on earth than there are males. So it is not surprising that people with a hierarchical worldview start with this issue.
We're talking with Gloria Steinem right now. She's a writer, a lecturer, editor, and feminist activist. And Gloria, you've been, as we said, an activist for years during the era that gave us Roe versus Wade, for instance. How would you compare what you can make out of the coming Trump era, maybe to some of what reproductive rights activists have been through in the past?
You know, I do not, and I think most Americans will not, live in the Trump era. I think that he is not representative, if you look at the public opinion polls, of majority opinions in this country in almost any of the positions that he has taken. I think what we are seeing is a backlash against the progress that has been made and the majority issues, that the majority views that are held by most Americans. What is a first in history is to have someone with so little experience and so much willingness to go against the majority opinion because he was elected by a backlash, and that's what's dangerous. However, I do see that people in other parts of the world have handled this in various ways, and we can too. For instance, in Poland recently, where there was a very great effort to completely outlaw abortion and to make the already strict laws about it much worse, 6 million women turned out in the street. 6 million. Is that not an incredible number? And the government was forced to change. So what we have here is a kind of massive popular opinion against the opinion, the apparent opinion of the chief of state, and we will use our numbers to make sure we keep reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right.
Well, there is the chief of state, but then there's also Congress, and Republicans control both chambers of the legislature and the White House. As you said, does that make this
difficult fight? Much more difficult, but. And makes many more things possible from the top down. But we must remember that we live life from the bottom up. And we are a democracy, and there are many ways in which unpopular wars or deprivation of voting power by citizens, you know, democratic rights, have been rebelled against, and we are going to rebel. I mean, we are not going to live in the era of Trump.
The country is hyper-polarized right now. For activists who may care about everything from immigration to Wall Street reform to reproductive rights, do you think it might be hard to fight a battle on so many fronts?
It's very difficult to have a profoundly unrepresentative president, but you already see that, for instance, the cities who have declared themselves sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants, New York, for instance, and our mayor, have already declared themselves to be ready to keep what they view as democracy and to keep faith with their neighbors, regardless of what the president does. We're in uncharted territory. We've never had a president who is so distant from the majority views of the country. He really won by being well known in the media without knowledge of what his actual views were on many, many issues. And as a backlash against Washington. In other words, many people who were impatient, understandably, with what happened in Washington, or suffering economically, voted for change for the sake of change without knowing what was in the change to come. But we are still the majority. We still have all of our peaceful powers to use. For instance, the question of defunding Planned Parenthood is very much alive, even though, you know, a tiny percentage of what they do is abortion. Nonetheless, there is a great wish on the part of the ultra-right wing to defund them. We could take a certain amount of money, you know, wouldn't be much, out of our income tax. This happened during the Vietnam War, for instance. People took the portion of their tax that was going towards the Vietnam War, didn't pay it, put a letter in with their tax return and said, hello, I'm not paying this part of my tax. It's a way of voting against the war. We could do that with Planned Parenthood even more helpfully, because we could send the money to Planned Parenthood and then just put a note in with our IRS forms saying we've deducted this amount. The government is able to take it out of your bank account, but it costs way more to take it out of your bank account and go through that process than the government gets by collecting that money. So it becomes a form of voting. There are all kinds of things that we can do from the bottom up.
I want to close by asking you about feminism and that term feminism. Where are we with the feminist movement today, and is it, do you think, still an active force, not just for women of older generations, but for young women?
Yes, it is. It is more than ever before. I mean, the millennials are way, way, way more feminist by every measure than my generation or than most previous generations. So this is a backlash. This is not the majority. All the issues of social justice that we think of do have the majority in public opinion polls. So, you know, partly this is the result of a low voting rate. It's the result of a lack of information and just voting for change for the sake of change, but it doesn't represent most Americans.
Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gloria Steinem is a writer, lecturer, editor, and feminist activist. In 1972, she co-founded Ms. Magazine, and she joined us there to talk about the future of reproductive rights in the new Republican-led federal government.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. President-elect Donald Trump's victory in Wisconsin broke a trend. It was the first time since 1984 that a Republican candidate won the state, but it's also becoming clear that Trump's victory has changed partisan trends within Wisconsin. Some blue parts of the state turned red, and some red parts of the state went blue.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief and resident data cruncher. He recently wrote that the state's political map has been scrambled. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, before we dig down into the details here, it looks like from some of your earlier reporting, I think based on exit polls, we saw some big changes at the county level. What is the story now that you're digging down to local governments, towns, local levels of voting?
Yeah, I mean, what you really see is all these really small towns and villages across Wisconsin where there were massive swings in the vote. There were more than 500 of communities in Wisconsin that Obama carried in 2012 that Trump carried in 2016. And it wasn't just that, but the movement. I mean, there's a lot of places where Obama won by 10, 20, or 30 points, and Trump won by 10, 20, or 30 points, or places that Obama won by 5 or 10, and Trump won by 40. So those really dramatic swings overwhelmingly occurred in northern, central, and western Wisconsin, and they overwhelmingly occurred in very small communities. I mean, the typical, you know, town or village where this happened, you know, had a population of 500, 600, 700 people.
And a big argument among Democrats and others is over whether Donald Trump won the election by taking Democratic voters away from Democrats, or Democrats just didn't show up at the polls. I know
there's always an element of both, but you know, at least in the places I'm talking about, you don't get swings that massive when it's just a question of Democrats staying home or just a question of turnout effects, because these are small communities where there's, you know, if you have, you know, a place where where there's 400 voters and you go from, 60-40 Democratic to 60-40 Republican, some of those voters are switching.
Somebody switched their vote, clearly.
There's a lot of switching going on. There were some turnout effects. There's no way to say with precision. But clearly it goes beyond just depressed Democratic turnout. These are places where the swings were so large that there were, people were shifting party allegiances.
Let's talk about the extreme swings here, and let's start with Steuben in western Wisconsin. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, you're only talking about 50 votes, but you're going from, a 35 or 38-point Democratic margin to a 35 or 38-point Republican margin. So it's a swing of 73 points. That was the extreme. You also had a lot of small communities, in western Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin, where you had 40, 50, and 60-point swings in the margins again. So it wasn't just a function of being a really small place where a few people changed their minds. And when you add up all the places that, let's say, were under 1,000 or 2,000 people, those votes really added up. And they, more than anything else, got Republicans from a 7-point deficit statewide under Romney to a very narrow win under Trump.
That is the Democrat-Republican swing, but you also found communities where things went the other way. Talk about where you saw big swings from Republicans to Democrats.
Yeah, so obviously you didn't get a uniform swing across the state, even though Trump won the overwhelming number of municipalities in Wisconsin. There were more than 100 where Trump did worse than Romney, and considerably worse, and that overwhelmingly happened again. It's very striking in higher education, higher income suburbs, both Democratic suburbs and Republican suburbs of Milwaukee. It happened to some extent in Dane County too, in more Democratic areas, but particularly in the metro Milwaukee area, the entire North Shore of Milwaukee, which in some cases is blue, but in some cases is purple, and in at least one case, River Hills, the wealthiest place in Wisconsin, is red. Those places all swung heavily in a Democratic direction. Clearly, these are voters who are reacting negatively to Donald Trump. But the same thing happened in Waukesha, parts of Waukesha and Ozaukee County. And where it happened was, again, more upscale, more well-to-do, higher rates of college education. In some of these Republican suburbs, Trump did worse than any Republican nominee in memory. And at the same time, in these more blue-collar exurbs, even in the southeastern Wisconsin, in some cases he did better than any Republican nominee in memory.
We are drilling deep into the presidential election results in Wisconsin with Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And yeah, an interesting thing about your piece that we're talking about, Craig, we've been seeing the county-by-county results. When you look closer, you're seeing big differences even within counties.
Yeah, and again, even within counties that are dominated by the same party. For example, I keep going back to Waukesha and Ozaukee counties, where you had in Ozaukee places like the city of Mequon or Cedarburg, where they became a lot less Republican in 2016 because you didn't have the enthusiasm for Trump. And that happened in the more densely populated and, the more affluent and the more educated communities within that Republican county. And it also happened in Waukesha, the same thing, places like the city of Brookfield, places like Village of Elm Grove, became less Republican. And Trump still carried every community in Waukesha County, but in the overwhelming number of those communities, he did considerably worse than Mitt Romney did. And this is important because, one of the reasons a lot of us thought that Trump was going to lose Wisconsin was because of his weakness in the Republican base, which are these suburban counties. And that weakness was real. In fact, we saw it on Election Day. It's just that he more than made up for it by these dramatic swings and his huge surge in these small towns across northern, western, and central Wisconsin.
He made up for that, you're saying, in these small towns. How do those small towns map onto state legislative politics, state races for governor?
Well, in Governor Walker's three elections, he did dominate rural Wisconsin. And the rural vote in Wisconsin is really interesting. In a lot of states, it's overwhelmingly Republican. But the history in Wisconsin has been that it's more purple. Obama won the rural vote in his 2008 election, which is pretty remarkable. And he didn't lose it by all that much in 2012. But Donald Trump won it by, you know, 20 or 30 points this time around. And that's a bigger, you know, he did better, considerably better than George W. Bush did or any other recent Republican nominee. The point is the Democrats in a state like Wisconsin, one reason Wisconsin has been a blue-leaning presidential state is that Democrats have been competitive with rural voters, which is like a third of the electorate, and they've even been dominant in some parts of the state, like southwestern Wisconsin, with rural voters. One of the reasons Scott Walker dominated in his gubernatorial elections is that he really dominated the rural vote, but we hadn't seen it at the presidential level until this election.
Craig, we've spent most of our time on the numbers here. Do we have an understanding of the why? What motivated rural voters to switch from supporting Obama 8 years ago, not letting Obama get beaten too badly in rural areas 4 years ago, to a big win for Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the thing that is going to be a subject of endless and is a subject of endless debate going forward, is how much of it is economics, how much of it is culture. You do have when you look at the rural vote in the exit polls, you find that it was more anti-Hillary Clinton than suburban and urban voters. It was less anti-Trump than suburban. It was more negative about the economy. It was more negative about trade and immigration. I think it's a combination of cultural and economic issues and also a more generalized sense of people being frustrated and frustrated at Washington, frustrated economically. All those things that we think of as sort of fueling the Trump vote, those things are more intense in rural Wisconsin, and this education divide, which was such a signature of this election, is, you really find it in rural Wisconsin because you have lower levels of college graduation in these rural areas, and so the mix of voters is different. Obviously, they're overwhelmingly white. None of these explanations is necessarily all that satisfactory in isolation, but some of it is pro-Trump, but some of it is also anti-Clinton. I mean, even among rural voters, Trump had a negative rating of around 50%. So he was not universally popular in rural areas, but a lot of these voters who had reservations about him voted for him anyway, partly because they were so negative about Hillary Clinton.
We'll talk about complicated answers. I guess this next one's going to be even more complicated. Is this a long-term realignment, and how will we know if it is?
We're not going to know for a while. I mean, I think you have to be cautious about, I mean, we have this discussion every time there's a striking election result, and certainly we had it when Obama swept the state in 2008 by much larger margins than Donald Trump. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Donald Trump didn't win 50% of the vote in Wisconsin, and he only won the state by 0.7 of a point. Yet he made big strides over what Mitt Romney and John McCain did. But he didn't, you know, George W. Bush, you know, came almost as close to winning the state in 2000 and 2004. So be cautious about, you know, kind of the realignment theory. At the same time, you know, Democrats, if you're a Democrat, you know, the Democratic Party has to figure out how to shore itself up with rural and blue-collar voters in a state like Wisconsin, a state where they have traditionally been competitive and where they can't afford to lose these voters by overwhelmingly margins because they're such a big part of the electorate. But I think part of the answer is long-term, in the sense that we're seeing a growing urban-rural divide, and we're seeing a growing education divide. So the Trump election sort of fits into those longstanding patterns. But it also goes beyond them because of the nature of Trump's candidacy, the nature of his message, and also the nature of Hillary Clinton and her unpopularity with these voters. So there's some interesting trends going on in Wisconsin. You see you see it in the comparison between the Senate race and the presidential race, where Donald Trump outperformed Ron Johnson in these more rural areas, particularly in western and northern Wisconsin, and Ron Johnson outperformed Donald Trump in these suburbs we've been talking about. A lot of it is going to depend on the Trump presidency going forward and whether he can find a way to kind of knit together these different components of the Republican coalition and hold on to some of these independent, even Democratic voters who voted for him last month.
We'll leave it there for now. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
That was Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Washington Bureau Chief. He joins us to talk about how partisan loyalties in Wisconsin shifted in President-elect Donald Trump's win.